supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Well, tonight at 7:05, Tommy Hansen is up for the Braves. You're listening to WHYY.
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we have a very interesting question of the week for you coming up. It's all about herbs, a practical primer on herbs that are easy to grow, herbs that need a little bit of help to get started, and the story about which herbs are annual and which herbs are perennial. It often depends on which herbal family member you're talking about and where you live. So there's a lot of good information coming up you won't want to miss. But mostly it's also a phone call show, cats and kittens, and you know what that means. We're taking that heap and helping at 1-888-346-9499. Julie, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike.
Hello, Julie. How are you?
I'm doing well. I just ordered a wonderful vegetable meal here in a Thai restaurant in the middle of Oklahoma City.
Okay, so if we hear clinking noises in the background, it's your fellow diners.
Exactly. So, well, I have a question for you, but I'm also getting ready for you to, oh dear, slap me across my hands. How's that? My green thumb. What I have is a yard that has really, really poor soil. I sent it off to be analyzed, and short of nuclear contamination, it can't be much worse.
Yeah.
So I'm doing a bunch of raised beds, but the end of my yard, I'm kind of letting it go and fend for itself, and what I want it to do is kind of look like a wild area. I grew up in South Dakota on the prairie in South Dakota, and of course there's lots of prairie flowers there and here in Oklahoma, and so this is where the slap on the wrist comes. I've actually been going out into fields and digging up wildflowers and transplanting them into my backyard.
That is a bad thing to do.
I know.
Now, Julie, unfortunately, we are going to have you arrested, so we're now GPSing your cell phone. What's the name of this Thai restaurant, just so we can call 911?
Actually, it's Italian.
Yeah. Now, it's perfectly okay to take some seeds at the end of the season. But there have been, for instance, I don't think that you've been digging up colonies of terrestrial orchids, native wild orchids, or anything like that.
No.
But
I'm pretty much sure of that. It's been yarrow and fleabane and coreopsis and allium species, galardia, mm-hmm. that type of thing. And I do recognize a weed when I see it, but I shouldn't do it.
Well, you mentioned one of my favorite wild plants, fleabane, which sounds terrible, but is actually a very tall-stemmed plant with mm-hmm. very beautiful, tiny flowers at the top, often dozens on a plant, and they look like little daisies, and they have a remarkable color range, and sometimes a specific plant in this species will go through a color change, will be a light purple and turn orange. They're remarkable plants, but I'm telling you, you can be done if you have these plants established, because fleabane self-seeds really readily. And what I do, because I love to have it in my garden, because the tiny compound flowers are the perfect attractors of beneficials and pollinating insects, that I literally just weed whack what I don't want mm-hmm. and allow, you know, a couple of dozen plants to come up. I do the same with mullein, with common mullein, which I just a random plant showed up in my garden. I like the flower spike with the tall sulfur-colored flowers at the top. And so I let it self-seed itself in the garden. And typically in the spring, I'll weed out 90% of the plants, and just it'll look like I have a deliberate specimen plant planted
right,
back there.
Right.
But if you've brought in these plants that are remarkable self-seeders, you can consider yourself slapped on the wrist, and but you can stop now because they will fill in the area brilliantly. These are, well, most of the plants you named are very good at colonizing.
Right.
And all you have to do to encourage that is nothing.
Yep, exactly. Exactly. Well, I took two or three plants and put them in three places at the back of the garden, and I'm pretty much letting them go. You know, and what happens, what happens. If they do seed, they seed. If they don't, well, I consider myself slapped by Mike McGrath, and I won't do it again.
Well, not personally, just in my yes. position as defender of the planet. If this is recent, I do hope you keep them watered over the summer so they can become established.
Yes, I do make sure, especially the newly, I planted the last one probably about 2 or 3 weeks ago. Just keep an eye on it.
If you find that as your plants establish, if you find that you did take something that maybe you shouldn't have, and it propagates in your garden, take some back. Take some back. You can always go back to the store 8 years later and pay for that scarf you stole.
This is true. This is true.
And anybody who's planting anything this time of year, this would be a good reason to put down a nice light mulch around the plants and have a little bit of a heavy hand with the water, because this is a terrible time of year for plants to get established, mm-hmm. even wild ones.
Exactly.
All right.
All right. Well, I so appreciate you taking my call, and have a good time in Philadelphia for the summer.
I will. Me and my fleabane. We'll talk about you and your fleabane.
Okay, that sounds good.
All right, Julie.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Cody, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello.
Hello, Cody. How are you, sir?
Good, good.
And where is Cody Good?
I am in Nevada, Missouri, Southwest Missouri.
Okay, very good. Cody from Southwest Missouri, what can we do you for, sir?
I'm interested in starting a hop garden, of growing my own hops. You know, I brew my own beer and just thought of, I'm sure there's a way, you know, to grow it. I just didn't know really how to get started. I figured I'd try to do something in the fall and just wondered what I needed to do to prep the bed and how they grow best and everything like that.
Well, this is interesting. This is, you're giving me flashbacks, because I guess it was 4 or 5 years ago, we got a call from a member of the Weyerbach family, and Weyerbach is a great local Pennsylvania brewery. And as you may know, depending on how long you've been brewing your own beer, I guess it was about 7 or 8 years ago, there was a real hop crisis. Most of the hops used by American brewers are imported from Europe, and there was a huge price increase, there were hop shortages, and a lot of small to medium-sized breweries investigated growing their own hops, which was tremendously common in America at one point. Now, I will tell you that here in Pennsylvania, where I helped the Weyerbach establish their hop farm and where friends of mine grew hop plants, hops grow sensationally. Hops are vines. They're perennials, but they do a lot of dieback at the end of the season, like a lot of plants. You know, they mostly die back to the ground at the end of the season and regrow. Once they get established, a few plants produces an enormous amount of leaf matter and the flowers that are used in brewing. And one of my favorite results of helping the Weyerbach is a couple of years later, they brewed a batch of fresh hops beer. Using the fresh green hops as opposed to the traditional dried hops. Oh, and if you're a hophead, if you like those really hoppy beers, that was just absolutely sensational.
Like an IPA or something, yeah.
But I have a real concern about your location.
Really?
Yeah, the one thing that hop plants are the most sensitive to is disease caused by high humidity. And
hey, we definitely have that.
I do remember being in southern Missouri one July speaking at an herb festival, and I thought somebody had thrown me into a swimming pool. But when I opened my eyes, I was actually walking down a city street.
Yeah, it's very humid here.
So I think that technically the hops would be considered viable for your zone. They are enormous plants, Cody, when they are fully grown towards the end of summer. Once a hop plant is like 5, 6, 7 years old, it will become massive by the end of summer. So I think, like most plants, however, I think you're going to find your starter plants and you're probably going to have your most success planting them in the spring.
Yeah.
That said, if you can find plants in the fall, there wouldn't be anything wrong with planting them. You may actually gain a year on perennializing them then, because that, by definition, would be a plant that grew that year that had already died back. So you, yours would be in the ground already. But I think if you gave them morning sun, lots of sun, good airflow, and lots of room between the plants, I think your humidity problems would be minimized. Although I would even suggest trimming off the bottom of the plant as we approach the real humid parts of July and August to make sure that air flowed underneath them. But if you could meet all those requirements, I think you'd get some hops.
Yeah.
All right, Cody?
Yeah, thank you.
Good luck.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Take care.
Yep, bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind gardeners with great harvests coming in that local food banks would love to accept the donation of any produce you can spare. So contact your local food bank and see exactly how you can get your surplus squash into the hands of the people who need it most. But don't go looking for the food bank locator at our website just yet, because we'll be right back with lots more of your fascinating phone calls and a primer on culinary herbs, the growing and the hardiness thereof. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible in part by Burpee. Burpee offers seeds and live plants, edibles, flowers and perennials, treasured heirlooms, and high-performing hybrids. More information online at burpee.com.
You're listening to You Bet Your Garden on WHYY.
Food waste disposers grind up your food scraps and send them through the sewer system to Philadelphia's wastewater treatment plants, where they're converted into renewable energy and fertilizer. More information at philadelphiastreets.com. InSinkErator supports WHYY.
WHYY is supported by Choose PA Wind, an initiative designed to help local businesses and homeowners to understand clean, Pennsylvania-sourced wind energy. More information on using wind energy to power homes and businesses at ChoosePAWind.com.
Are so-called recession-proof jobs a thing of the past?
You're getting a lot of new nurses coming out of school into a market where some of them are having trouble finding jobs, which is a very unusual phenomenon historically.
I'm Sarah Gardner. A new reality for nurses, underemployment. That's next time on Marketplace Money from APM.
This afternoon at 3 on WHYY.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, a listener pointed out that we've really never done just a general primer on growing culinary herbs. And there's so much confusion over which herbs are annual and which ones are perennial and how far north certain herbs can grow. So we're going to list all of the big herbal families and tell you about their best known family members. But mostly, it's a phone call show, cats and kittens, and you know what that means. We're taking that heaping helping of your telecommunicated questions, comments, tips, tricks, etc. at 1-888-346-9499. Allison, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. I'm from Regina, Saskatchewan, Canada.
Oh, listener to the far north there.
yeah. So I have a question about landscaping ties.
Okay, proceed.
Well, we moved into a new-to-us house here, and it was built in about the mid-'80s, and it has a tiered kind of garden in the backyard, and all the landscaping ties are kind of deteriorating, so they need to be replaced. We are not sure what to replace them with. My husband's looking for the easiest thing to do, but I don't want to replace, which I think it was pressure-treated wood, with pressure-treated wood. I was thinking maybe cedar or even Trex or stone.
So you have a terraced garden.
Right. It has like three levels, and we like that. We're going to get rid of just a little area to make room for the hot tub.
Ooh.
We need to replace this. That there's like spikes sticking out of it, and right. Our little kids are going to get hurt.
Yeah. So I guess in Saskatchewan, a hot tub is not a luxury, right? That's
it's a necessity.
It's just to keep you emotionally alive over the winter, which lasts about what? About 48 weeks?
Is it? Just about, yeah.
So, yeah, what you want to do is you want to wear very heavy protective gloves when you remove this old material.
Okay.
One of the biggest dangers, especially with material this old and rotting, is the dermal contact.
Okay.
We can pick up arsenic really easily by touching a wood that's been treated with arsenic. And if they were old railroad ties, for instance, which the big spikes lead me to believe they might have been, they're treated with creosote, which even scientists who say chemicals don't cause cancer, they acknowledge that creosote causes cancer. So
Okay. You
want to be really careful in that area. Wear gloves. Make sure it gets bagged up and sent to the most responsible type of trash disposal you can find. And get rid of some of the old soil, the soil that was in contact with as much of it. When I built my raised bed garden, I wound up using a lot of field stone because my raised bed garden was originally filled with stones.
Mm-hmm.
So I used local stone, I mean, as local as you could get. I mean, rather than drag it out of the garden and bring some stuff in, I turned the stones on their sides and made like little tiny stone walls and stuff. So if you have stone on your property like that, that is the most cost-effective, and it will last literally forever.
Oh, okay.
If you want something that's going to look nice, that's going to accent the hot tub, I don't know. No, I'm serious. I don't mind the hot tub at all. I'm thinking I'm going to make a visit to Saskatchewan. It's been too long.
Well, you should.
Pavers would look sensational, and they would match the pavers that you could match the pavers you already have out there. Get a really nice, even look that would enhance the value of the home. You mentioned Trex, which is a composite material made from approximately half wood shaving waste and half a recycled reclaimed plastic. I have beds in my garden that were framed with Trex back in the late 80s, and they are in perfect shape. They look brand new, the Trex lumber. But if you can get, you know, third grade cedar, something like that, knotty cedar, knotty redwood. I know sometimes in certain situations you can even get reclaimed redwood and cedar when they take apart old picnic benches. Some people have been lucky enough who live near harbors to be able to get mahogany and teak that were recovered from old sailing ships.
Oh, that would be beautiful.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, well, great. Thank you very much, and I'd like to say that we are Philadelphia Union fans up here in Saskatchewan.
Really? You follow our soccer team?
Yes. My brother-in-law lives in Philly with his two boys and his wife, and he's involved in the team there. So go Union.
Go Union. All right. Well, we are just quadrangly international here.
Yeah.
All right. Well, good luck, Allison, and enjoy
Thank
your hot
you.
Tub this winter.
You bet. You can come anytime.
I'll be there.
Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Peter, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Peter. How are you?
Very good. Glad to be talking to you.
And where is Peter Good?
I am in Malvern, Pennsylvania, down the main line.
Yeah, just outside of Philadelphia. Very good. What can we do for you?
We've got a rather large, this is now larger than a football-sized wasp's nest hanging off the side of the side porch of the house, not far from vegetable garden with raised beds and so on and so forth. Well, these are the kind that build the papery, gray, conical nest.
They're cartoon characters.
Exactly.
They are, you know, they're a universal language. They're like a comic strip thing, a cartoon thing. Everybody knows. And of course, if it's a true cartoon, if it's an animated cartoon, it has to be built over Donald Duck's doorway, right?
Yeah. Well, in this case, it's built over our doorway, so we have to be pretty careful going in and out of this porch, and so we don't use that door quite so often. It's about 15 feet up in the air, so it's not a huge problem. I don't want to get rid of it unless I absolutely have to, because my guess is that these guys eat bad bugs, and I'm better off having them around than not having them around unless they present themselves as a danger.
No one has been stung, right?
No.
Okay.
No. We've been pretty careful about it.
All right. Well, I'll tell you, you are, I'm very pleased you called. This is just a wonderful topic. Thank you for not killing them.
Mm-hmm.
They are, these hornets, these wasps, are stinging insects. When hornets build an aerial nest, a lot of times there is no reason for people to overreact. This happened to my wife and I guess it's about 7 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
We have a deck that goes out from our bedroom, a little like balcony where we can sit outside, look in the woods, look
right
at the stream. And very similar hornets built a nest up in the peak of the roof, and it was freaking my wife out. And I did some research. I already knew, you know, a couple of things. I knew that that nest would not be reused the next year.
Right.
Wasps and hornets don't reuse old property. They build a new house every year. And I also felt comfortable that it was high enough that the insects were not going to impact us. And I also said I'd get stung to death if I tried to take it down.
Yeah.
So she reluctantly let it up there. And then the season progressed. We kind of forgot about it. It got bigger and bigger. And then one night in the fall, we were outside in the early evening, and we heard sounds coming from the nest, almost, again, like Krypton exploding in a Superman cartoon. You could see like little cartoon bulges coming out the side. And I thought, oh, my God, have I made just a horrible miscalculation? But then two of the fattest chickadees you have ever seen came bursting out of that nest, and they had devoured all of the wasps and the hornets. And it was just so funny. The birds barely could fly. They had doubled their weight up there. In terms of them being beneficial in the garden, absolutely. They go after tomato hornworms, mm-hmm, and broccoli green worms and corn earworms and root worms. And
those guys have typically been our biggest problems. So I, too, am thankful that I left these wasps up there.
Yes, they should not impact you. They should be high up enough that they're not looking at you as a threat. And if you don't make any threatening gestures to them,
right,
I don't see them coming down after you. They certainly didn't bother with us. It was live and let live. And I did notice no tomato hornworms in my garden that year, for
mm-hmm
instance. At the end of the season, either birds will invade that nest and feast on it, as we saw, or the queen at the end of the season, she will leave the nest, and she'll overwinter somewhere else, and she'll start a new colony somewhere else in the spring.
Right.
And after that, you can take it down as a souvenir or something if you like. Or
What time would that be, in the fall after it's clear that it's empty, or wait till spring?
I would wait till the next spring.
Okay.
I would wait till the next spring just to
be
safe.
They won't reuse it, so in fact, if I leave it up, it can present itself as a rival nest.
I think that's a brilliant idea, and so far, Peter doesn't have to do anything. It's a good day, right?
It is.
And you got great-looking insects eating your caterpillars. It's a better day.
Yeah, all right. Win-win all around. Okay.
All right, good luck,
terrific,
Peter.
Thanks very much, Mike.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Kirsten, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, how are you, Mike?
Very good. Kirsten, how are you?
I'm great, thank you.
And where is Kirsten great?
I am in Middle Tennessee.
Okay, very good. What can we do you for?
I have peach trees that are around 6 years old. I don't spray pesticides, or I don't want to do anything environmentally damaging.
Right.
And when my peaches, which are coming in, well, were coming in well, turn from green to more ripened colors, they get moldy.
Yeah.
And they fall off the trees, and
yes.
I don't know what to do.
Well, I presume that you are experiencing the scourge of all peach growers, which is a disease commonly known as brown rot. It shows up super fast. I mean, you think you got the tiger by the tail and everything is going really well, and it shows up as a tiny little spot on one peach, and man, before you know it, it just covers the peach, and then all the others are jumping over the edge of the cliff with it. It is the reason many peach lovers have cut down their trees after time. I consider peaches to be the most work that you can get into when you plant. Now, did you plant these trees yourself?
I did, yes.
And you planted them 6 years ago, and how many trees do you have?
I have about five.
Here, see, that's like asking somebody how many children they have, and they say six or seven. You got to know how many, you know.
Well, I also have other fruit trees, so it's hard to, I have five.
Okay.
I have apples and other trees, too.
So. Okay, so, you know, you're in a world of trouble. You know how much trouble the apple trees are as well, right?
Yes.
Okay, so do you heavily prune the trees sometime between late winter and early spring?
No, I just kind of cut the crossed branches.
Then you don't have a prayer. Or we can help you have a good shot at getting peaches next year. And I went through this. Don't feel bad. I planted peach trees for my wife, I guess it's about 10 years ago almost. And in the beginning, I thought I was pruning them very well. I was pruning them every year. And then we had my good friend Lee Reich on the show, whose books I recommend, by the way, for you specifically. His name is Lee Reich, R-E-I-C-H. And he is the author of The Pruning Book, because he's not very shy about his abilities and knowledge. But he also has a brand new book out called Grow Fruit Naturally, which covers the ways to grow all the different backyard fruits without any chemical inputs. Every year, just about, he has a new book out, so we have Lee on the show. And he always yells at me, even without seeing my peaches, he knows I'm not pruning them enough. So this year, I pruned them heavily, and then we had Lee on the show, and he said, can you throw a cat through the remaining branches? And I said, what? And he said, for peach trees, which require the heaviest pruning of any tree out there, once you are done pruning, you should be able to pick up a cat and throw it through the branches without the cat hitting any of the branches. And I said, well, that's a very disturbing image. And he says, yes, but people don't forget it when they're pruning. So I suspect you're like me and you're a coward. That you know,
I am.
And you got it. You have to give it up. You really have to remove. What I did is I removed a solid third of each tree when they began to flower this spring. And then, you know, peach trees grow so lustily that a month later, it really didn't look like I had pruned that much. So I pruned them again. Until finally, I could see the difference now that there was airflow. There were no branches touching each other. So I think we need to prune peach trees more than we think is necessary and more than we're comfortable with. If we step away from our peach trees and look up at it and go, oh my God, what have I done? Lee would probably say we did a good job. Now, after you're done not pruning, when the fruits start forming, do you thin the fruits heavily?
They all fall off.
No, no, no. See, if you let them get to that stage that you're not being a good mother. That's why I say that these trees are the most work, because not only do you have to prune them heavily, but when the fruits start to form, you need to go in and pull off. Lee says in commercial orchards, they only leave 5%. Of the fruit, but that's how you get the big, fully formed peaches like you see in the store. You have to remove at least every other one. There has to be room in between the fruits that you could put another peach in there, so to speak. Even though it seems counterintuitive, the more you thin, the more peaches you're going to get at harvest time.
I got it. So what about the scourge? How do you prevent that?
Airflow. Airflow and energy for the trees. Don't feed them chemical fertilizers. Don't mulch them with any kind of wood. Keep grasses and weeds away from their base. Make sure there's nothing growing underneath them. Make sure the trees don't touch each other. Make sure there's airflow in between the trees and in between each branch of the tree. Thin the fruits heavily, and then the tree has what it needs to hold this scourge back.
Right, I gotcha. Sounds good. I'm excited now.
Okay, and get one of Lee's books. It'll hold your hand. He'll be much more gentle with you in the book than he was with me in person.
Thank you.
And remember, peaches are hard work.
Oh, yeah, thanks. I'm excited now.
All right.
Thanks,
well,
Mike.
The reward is great. Take care.
Thank you. Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everyone what planted garlic last fall that harvest time is here. Garlic should be harvested when one-third of each plant has turned brown. Do not let garlic stay in the ground until the entire plant is brown, or your previously precious cloves will do a good imitation of George Washington's old dentures. But don't go frantically yanking your big bulbs out of the ground just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and an excellent little primer on growing your own culinary herbs. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Herbal Garden.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible in part by Burpee. Burpee has been providing gardeners with seeds, plants, and supplies for growing everything from tomatoes to flowers to gourmet herbs for over a century. More information online at burpee.com.
You're listening to WHYY. It's 11:38.
This is Jeff Bundy, WHYY's Director of Member Relations. On August 3rd, WHYY TV and PBS stations across the country will be premiering a new documentary produced locally by WHYY. The Barnes Collection tells the story of Dr. Albert C. Barnes and his impressive art collection. Support WHYY's local productions with a $120 donation and we'll thank you by sending you two tickets to visit the Barnes Foundation's new home on the Ben Franklin Parkway. Call 1-888-345-9499 or visit WHYY.org.
94 degrees in Center City, on our way to a high of 101 today. Later today on Fresh Air Weekend, Bridget Lancaster and Jack Bishop from America's Test Kitchen talk grilling and summer foods. They'll offer practical tips on vegetables, meat, and fish. We'll compare charcoal to gas grills. And Lancaster and Bishop will share favorite recipes for summer soups and salads. Join us for Fresh Air Weekend at 1 today here on WHYY. And this quick reminder, find out how you can double or even triple your gift to WHYY at no cost to you. Visit WHYY.org/matching.
Teachers from grades 7 through 12 can take their classroom skills to the next digital level. WHYY, through American Graduate, is now offering scholarships for teachers to attend a special course, Visual Storytelling Basics for the Classroom, at WHYY's Hamilton Commons. Learn firsthand how smartphones, still cameras, and simple free editing software can enhance your classroom and encourage students. Classes are October 6th or November 3rd. Apply for your full scholarship now at WHYY.org/American Graduate.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week. Culinary herbs. They're some of the easiest things you can grow if you know the type of herbs that grow best in your region. Different herbal family members have very different requirements and offer very different rewards. We'll tell you a lot about the main family members after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Glenn, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
How are you doing, Mike?
Very good, Glenn. How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine over here in Wayne, Pennsylvania.
Very good. Just outside of Philadelphia. What can we do for Glenn in Wayne, PA?
Yes, Mike. We own a lakeside property on a lake up in New Hampshire. And our lake is experiencing a cyanobacteria problem, which is really, I guess, a cause of some elevated water temperatures and high phosphorus levels, I guess, in the lake.
Right.
I was wondering, is it beneficial to keep the lawn higher in order to uptake more phosphorus in the lawn and prevent it from running into the lake?
Well, unfortunately, there are still lawn fertilizers available that contain phosphorus.
It seems like everyone that I know of is very cautious of that, not applying fertilizers with phosphorus.
Good.
If you're lakeside.
There are bans against it in certain communities. I'm pretty sure there's some real new lawn legislation around the Washington, D.C. area and the areas that feed into the Chesapeake Bay. And
right.
They're now regulating not only the content of lawn fertilizers, but what time of year you can use them and how much you can use to try to mitigate these pollution problems. It's not just your lake. Now, phosphorus in the soil is very interesting. If you were a gardener, for instance, your soil test showed that you were highly deficient in phosphorus. That would mean typically that you would not be getting the number of flowers or fruits or things that you wanted out of your garden. Your plants might be a little lethargic as well. You would have a lot of different options for adding phosphorus to the soil, one of which is a mined mineral known as rock phosphate. And rock phosphate is, has a very high phosphorus content. But by researching it and knowing that, small amounts of rock phosphate added to the soil really improve the flowering health of plants, it only needs or should only be added to soil like once every 5 years maximum, because phosphorus remains in the soil. It doesn't travel around as easily as nitrogen. So once phosphorus is in soil and once it's in plants, it is pretty stable. And if I'm following your question correctly, I would think that cutting a lawn at the proper height, which would be in Pennsylvania, 3 inches in the sun, 3.5 inches in the shade, and then returning those clippings to the soil, would definitely keep the phosphorus out of your lake the maximum amount possible.
Right.
At cutting low would subject the lawn to erosion and, would carry some soil away. And any soil that gets carried into the lake is going to take its phosphorus with it, and then the phosphorus will leave the soil. It would rather be in the water. So by keeping the lawn cut at the right height, you develop a deep root system that holds that soil in place, holds the phosphorus in place, and by returning the clippings to the soil, a well-managed lawn to which no new phosphorus is added, I think would utilize that phosphorus in the soil and in the grass and have the minimalist amount migrating into the water, whereby a lawn that is scalped, maybe not for the reasons you were thinking, but a lawn that is scalped and poorly cared for would help the soil release its phosphorus into the water source. There's nothing but benefit to a correct cut, whereby scalped lawns, I almost can guarantee, I can almost see the phosphorus washing into the lake.
Okay, Mike, that sounds like some good information.
You got some edumacating to do there. Glenn, you got to go learn your neighbors good.
Yeah, I'll have to get in the workshop and put together a soapbox.
All right. Good luck, man.
Okay, thank you.
Take care. 1-888-346-9499. Gloria, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Well, thank you, Mike. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Gloria. Where are you?
I am in Joelton, Tennessee. That's about 14 miles north of Nashville.
Okay, very good. What can we do for Gloria near Nashville?
Well, here's the sequence of events. About 4 or 5 days ago, I noticed a heavy infestation of aphids in the tomatoes, along with some other critters. While out in the garden, I disturbed two small swarms of green lacewing.
Oh, how nice.
And Yeah, it was wonderful. And so, of course, then I had to stop and think that through. And then a day or so later, I looked what I saw, what I thought might be the beginning of fruit worm invasions. So then I would want to spray with BT. So here is, I've got aphids and funguses and possible fruit worms,
okay,
all requiring a different spray.
Okay, so let's drop back. Are you gardening in raised beds or flat ground?
Flat ground.
Okay, and what are you feeding your plants?
I'm using Espoma Tomato Tone.
Oh, okay. Espoma is the company that makes Holly Tone. They're huge lines of natural fertilizers.
Yeah.
But no compost.
No, not a lot of compost. I do use a heavy straw mulch, which eventually breaks down and becomes soil.
Right, right, right. The only thing I can think of that you're doing to contribute to these pest problems, in addition to the fact that as you get down towards the Nashville area, the pest and disease pressures do honestly begin to build. I think that raised beds would relieve some of the insect pressure simply because plants do better when their soil isn't walked on, when their soil isn't compressed by human feet. Do you know what the larval form of the lacewing looks like? The baby lacewing.
Yes, the little alligator-looking form.
Very good. So what I would do is I would not use any insecticidal soap at this point.
Okay.
It's just too hot out. And
right.
It can really stress the plants. And I think it's unnecessary. In the studies that were done with aphids on roses, for instance, the sharp streams of water were more effective than insecticidal soap or commercial poisonous insecticides. So,
okay, but now if I use the jet wash at this point, then I'm going to be knocking off lacewing eggs. Is that not correct?
I think one of the things we have going for us here is aphids tend to cluster at the tops of plants and at the end
uh-huh.
of plant tips, whereby I'm guessing these eggs are mostly laid on the undersides of random leaves.
Right.
So I think this is just a question of getting out early one morning, having the hose with the nozzle you can set to the sharp spray, and do what you are considering with the insecticidal soap, which is a true knockdown.
Right.
And then I would not hesitate to use the BT right away if you're beginning to see caterpillar problems on your tomatoes, especially the fruit worms, because they get inside.
Exactly. So I'm going to have to take a closer look at that. The question, though, is like in using the copper fungicide.
Oh, copper
if I have
is
to use copper. The copper fungicide and the BT.
Mm-hmm.
If I apply the copper fungicide on Monday, then if I apply the BT on Tuesday, isn't that going to be washing the fungicide off?
Well, not only that, but the BT itself is a living organism, and the copper could kill it. There is a disease-fighting organism that is in its own way kind of similar to BT. It's a naturally occurring soil organism that's been isolated and is used to fight disease. And it's very effective. It's sold under the brand name Serenade, and it is an organism called Bacillus subtilis. And
right.
I think if you're going to be spraying BT to control your caterpillar problems using water to get rid of your aphids, I think if you stepped up to Serenade, you know, I would never tell people to mix things together in the same sprayer because I always
right.
worry that there's something going on that I'm not thinking about.
Right.
But I would not be afraid to use BT and Serenade a day or two apart. I don't think there'd be, and I don't think either one of them has the capacity to harm your lacewings or ladybugs or any of your beneficials.
Oh, okay. That sounds wonderful.
All right. Just remember to mist when you put the gentle stuff on.
Absolutely. Will do. Thank you so much.
All right. Good luck, Gloria.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. Growing culinary herbs, a practical primer. Speaking of practical and prim, here is our producer, Alexis Landis, to read us this week's question.
Well, we heard from Rodney in Traverse City, Michigan, who writes, I live in one of the most northern zones, only get moderate to light sun, and would appreciate a segment about growing herbs for cooking, including exactly which herbs are perennial. On a recent show, you mentioned that lemon thyme was an annual in the north, but the plant tags I've seen say that thyme is a perennial. I know that basil is annual, and mint and oregano are perennial, so what's the deal?
Well, herbs are some of the easiest things for a gardener to cultivate successfully. They can get by with a lot less sun than fruit-bearing plants, and most herbs do very well in containers. But the annual versus perennial issue can be really tricky. Many herb families have members that are perennial even in the most northern regions, but other family members that can only survive winter in the absolute warmest zones. In these cases, the genus, that's the plant family, is much more important than the specific species, the family member, under discussion. With that in mind, let's try to sort out some of the mysteries of the most common / favorite culinary herbs. Basil. There are an enormous number of different varieties, shapes, sizes, and colors of this herb. All are extremely frost-sensitive and need to be pinched back and/or harvested frequently to keep them from flowering. Like most herbs, the flavor of basil will change for the worse when flowers appear, so pinch off anything that looks like it'll bud. And maybe start new plants or sow fresh seed every month or so to ensure a good-tasting supply. Dill. Only the annual form of this herb is grown in the United States. Now, dill doesn't like to be transplanted. You'll get your best results when you sow the seeds directly in the ground or in your pot. If you mostly want the aromatic leaves, harvest them and pinch them back frequently to prevent flowering. If you just want the seeds, don't remove any leaves. Enjoy the flowers, which are great attractors of beneficial insects, and then wait until the seed pods are really dry to harvest. Another good candidate for the planting of successive runs. Mint. Mint is a huge and diverse family, almost every member of which is an aggressive grower that can easily become invasive. Grow mint in containers, surround it with deep edging, watch for escaping runners, and don't allow the plants to flower unless you want a mint farm. Peppermint and spearmint are perennial in the harshest climates, while most of the so-called fruit-flavored mints are grown as annuals north of Zone 6. Pineapple, lime, orange, and chocolate mint are much less aggressive growers than most mints, while apple is one of the worst of the bunch. The crushed leaves of mint family members catnip and lemon balm make excellent natural mosquito repellents, and lemon balm is felt to be a more effective antidepressant than St. John's wort. Harvest mints early in the morning to get the highest essential oil content in their leaves. Oregano and marjoram. Both of these herbs share the same genus name, are sold interchangeably, and cross-pollinate readily, making totally accurate identification of any specific plant almost an impossibility even to experts. Winter survival is the best test. True Greek oregano is a Mediterranean native that won't survive winter north of Zone 7. Neither will the highly aromatic sweet marjoram or French marjoram. The hardy family members are common oregano and wild marjoram. They're a little less tasty, but still nicely edible, and they're perennial to Zone 5 and maybe even Zone 4 if they feel like it. No matter what the type, harvest and pinch frequently to prevent flowering. Parsley. Parsley doesn't like transplanting, and the seeds are real drama queens. Best method is to put the seeds in a little cloth bag, dip them in and out of a bowl of lukewarm water for 2 hours, and then plant them immediately in your container or in the ground. You gotta dip. If you just soak them, they'll die. Told you they were drama queens. Once parsley's up, let it grow. These plants are biennials that won't flower until their second year, so you can let the leaves get nice and big. Parsley is an excellent choice for growing indoors on a super sunny windowsill in winter. Rosemary is perennial only in excellent draining soil, in warm climes, or in sheltered locations in somewhat iffy zones. Unlike most herbs, flowering does not affect the flavor of rosemary. Sage. There are close to 1,000 different herbal members in the salvia family. Common garden sage, the essential stuffing herb, is perennial in the north. But like most of the rest of the salvias, delicious pineapple sage is an annual in all but the warmest zones. Its bright red tubular flowers are a favorite of hummingbirds, and the flowers are an edible human treat as well as the leaves. True white sage is also perennial only in warmer climes. It's grown for bees and to clear evil spirits out of a room. And like many sages, white sage has a foul taste. Thyme. This family also runs the gamut of winter hardiness. Common thyme has the best smell and flavor, but it's perennial only in zone 7 and warmer. Same for the excellent mosquito-repelling lemon-scented thyme. The species with a million aliases. It's known as creeping thyme, mother of thyme, wild thyme. That's the one that's perennial everywhere in the United States. Well, that sure were a lot of interesting herbal information now, weren't it, mateys? Luckily for ye, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To carefully review this week's edition with all the genus and species names of the herbs in question spelled out, just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes, my producer is threatening to dip me in lukewarm water for a couple hours if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched, refuse teeming towards our garden shore, at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live. Please put the actual subject in the subject line. And perhaps check voiced to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week, find the solution to hundreds of garden problems, just like yours, hint, hint, in our Garden Answers A to Z section, and or listen to this show, listen to old shows, and or download this week's podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Kevin. Don't call me Merv Griffin. Our webmaster is Baneful Rich Banowitz. His faithful internet companion is Sarah Kazar. The sage Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Minty Fresh Kelly Haggerty is our production assistant. Our esteemed editor is Basilie Al Banks. That's Basilie, not Paisley. I got nothing but time, Mike McGrath. So it should be easy to see you next week. An unseen danger of urban growing is the risk of lead contamination in your dirt. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss what to do when...